Hello and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, August 1st, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Before we get started, I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible, especially those of you who visit my website, carasantamaria.com, and click through to the Patreon portal. You can also access it by going to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/talknerdy, and pledging to support the show. This week, I want to thank our top dollar pledgers, Phil T-Bear, Stuart Ogg, welcome Stuart, Rod Adams, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but most, I have to be honest, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you so much for your support. You guys know that Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download and will always remain so. It will never be a subscription show. So to keep it functioning, I really appreciate the support that you give me, and this is one of the best ways to do it. You can also probably tell I'm really bad at asking for money. So if you're interested in supporting the show, do what these wonderful gentlemen did. Maybe we can get some ladies up in here. If not, you know, there's a lot of other ways to support the show. You can tell your friends. You can reach out on social media. You can do a follow Friday. That would be really nice. Or you can even rate and review on iTunes. That's a big help. All right, guys. This week is, I don't know, it's going to be an interesting episode. I've been struggling with whether or not I want to do this, but I think I'm doing it. Obviously, I'm recording. But this week, my mom is in town, and so I thought it would be fun to chat with her and let you guys eavesdrop a little bit, which is super weird and uncomfortable for me. Are you comfortable?
I'm fairly comfortable.
She's fairly comfortable, you guys. Well, this is my mom. Her name is Charlotte Salmon. Say hi.
Hello.
Hello. Obviously, I grew up with her. She raised me. I grew up, for those of you who don't know, in Plano, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas. I was born and raised there until I was probably like 24. And then I went to Denton for college, and then I moved to New York, and then I moved to LA. But my mom didn't always live in Dallas or even in Texas. So why don't you go ahead and tell everybody listening a little bit about where you were born, where you grew up, and how you kind of got to where you are now.
Okay. Well, I was born in New York City, and I am a baby boomer, so I was born right after World War II in 1948. Mm-hmm. When I was 8 months old, my mom took me to Puerto Rico to live with my grandmother while she and my dad tried to get work in New York after the war, which is very difficult. I lived with my grandmother in Puerto Rico till I was 5 years old. I only spoke Spanish. And I lived on a farm. We had no electricity and no water for a long time. And just before my mom came to get me, we finally got electricity and water. And I was so excited.
So wait, how did you have a pump or something? How did you drink water and cook and wash your clothes?
We caught water from the rain in big barrels. Mm-hmm. And there was a well that was about half a mile down the hill from the house. So we would take these large cans and fill them with water and carry them on our heads.
Yeah. Yeah. And so at the time, is it just that you were living in a part of Puerto Rico that was less developed, or was all of Puerto Rico a little bit less developed in, you know, in the 40s, 50s?
In the 40s, a lot of it was less developed. Mm-hmm. I lived near a city, I would say maybe a half-hour drive to the city, but you couldn't walk there.
Which city?
Definitely. Bayamón, which is one of the major cities right now. Yeah. It is on the side of the island where San Juan is located.
Yeah, when I visited, was it this year? Last year, I gave a talk in Puerto Rico to the Humanist Society there, an American atheist, and it was just in San Juan, and I was in the city. And obviously, it's a city. It's a big city. It's developed. But it's still a little slummy in parts, too. I mean, I definitely saw kind of both ends of the spectrum when I was in the city. But there was no, you know, rural areas that I saw, per se.
Right. Well, even in Bayamón, it's now creeping out into the countryside. Mm-hmm. And there are better roads, and they have all the utilities. But But I do remember one thing that would probably surprise you, and that is that we didn't have television until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we all gathered at a store that was about a mile from the house to watch TV for 2 hours, and then it shut off.
That was the only programming you got.
Right. And we all brought stools and chairs to sit outside the store and watch TV. It was the only TV around.
Interesting. And that was just how TV in Puerto Rico was? Because I'm sure in the States you got, I mean, I know there were only a few channels back then, but you still got programming during the waking hours at least, right?
Yeah. We only could receive for the 2 hours a day.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
And then, so when you were five, though, you moved out of Puerto Rico?
Yes. Then I moved to Cleveland. My mom moved to Cleveland, so I went with her and went to school there. Memories of Cleveland were kindergarten, where I didn't speak any English at all. And the teachers tended to yell a lot because they thought the louder they spoke, the more I would understand. All I understood was that they were angry with me.
I think that's a pretty common experience for young immigrant children, or for older immigrants, actually, and for people with disabilities. I remember taking, you know, having a corporate job once, and they had to train everybody with, like, disability sensitivity training. And that was one of the first things. It was like, if you just yell, they're not going to understand you any better. It's kind of just going to scare people. But for whatever reason, people do that. You notice, like dumb, jerky American tourists do that a lot when they're in other countries. They just yell louder.
But it's not just them. I've seen other people do it in other languages when they're trying to speak with someone who didn't understand them. And they just get louder and louder. And I think it's frustration.
Of course, yeah. And it must be just like this core kind of human action, because I see it in parallel a little bit. When we were camping last, we were playing Catchphrase, which is kind of like Taboo, but not with less rules. It's like a quick game where you get a phrase and you try to say everything you can to get people to guess what it is without actually saying the phrase. And some people who are really good at it, and they're very creative, and they can get people to guess right away. And other people just say the same thing over, or they point. Like, you can tell they do these things that are like really perseverative, where it's like, okay, you're not solving the problem that way, so maybe you should approach it differently. But for whatever reason, that's just, I think, innate in some people. Just keep hitting their heads against the wall.
That's it.
Yeah.
They don't know where to go from there.
Yeah. And so how long did you live in Cleveland?
I grew up in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I lived there till I was 23 years old.
So very similar to my experience in Plano.
Yes.
Except you had the first few years of your life where were someplace else. It's lucky that you started learning English at five, though. It must have been much easier to pick up.
Much easier. Plus, I had a wonderful teacher in elementary school. They didn't have bilingual classes or ESL classes, so you were expected just to pick it up. My first grade teacher, Miss DeGeneva, she would spend hours with me during recess after school, and we would argue. Because as I was learning the language, I would see differences between the Spanish and the English. Even though I hadn't learned to read and write in Spanish, it still didn't sound right to me.
Oh, yeah, because a lot of things are backward. The adjectives are after the nouns instead of before them. Or it feels backward to us, although most languages are actually more like Spanish, right?
Right. Well, pronunciation, too. That was crazy.
I can only imagine. Spanish is pretty phonetic.
Yes. and I would look at the word bear the way she had it written, B-A-R-E, and I go, that's not bear, that's bare.
Bare, yeah.
Yeah. So she learned a little bit about Spanish, and I learned a lot of English. I still had an accent when I went into second grade, and Miss Jones helped to get me over that. She would help me enunciate. And by the time I was in third grade, you'd never know that I spoke Spanish.
I cannot believe that you can remember the names of your, like, first and second grade teachers. I don't think I can remember the names of my early elementary school teachers.
I remember the ones that impressed me and that helped me. And there were a lot of really good ones along the way, but there were a few that just went the extra mile.
Yeah. I find your accent interesting because if you look at other people in our immediate family, right, my father, your ex-husband, many, many years ago, and also my sister, your daughter, they have very Southern accents.
Yes.
Right? A lot of people tell me that I don't have a Southern accent, but there's a few pronunciations of words that they can hear. We've talked about this before on the show, but putting the emphasis on syllables like insurance or umbrella, that's a very Southern way to pronounce those
cement.
Words. Cement. Yeah, that's true. And I do all of that. And you do that too. You have a little
sometimes,
bit of Southern.
Yeah.
But there are a couple words I hear you say that sound very Southern, but then your accent is like this weird hybrid Midwest New York Southern Spanish accent.
Yes.
Because you've lived a lot of places.
That's right. And that's what happens when you have an ear for languages. Mm-hmm. You tend to pick up the accent that's around. My accent for Spanish was a Puerto Rican accent.
Mm-hmm.
Once I moved to Texas, I picked up the Mexican accent. And when I teach, I try to use no accent.
So there is, in Spanish, even just like in English, there's kind of a neutral accent?
Yes, it's considered book Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the type of accent where nobody can pick up where you're from.
So when we think about English, right, we think about, well, I should only say American English, because obviously Australian English and British English sound very different. But in American English, what we think of as a neutral accent, a broadcast accent, for example, is Midwestern. It's more Midwestern.
Which is where I grew up.
Yeah, but in Spanish, is neutral book Spanish more like any particular country?
None that I'm aware of.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a hybridization of all of them, but also a lack of a lot of things
right.
in all of them. Okay.
Now, the Mexican accent actually pronounces things, I think, more clearly than other accents.
Interesting. Or more like the way that they're written?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. The Argentinian accent has the double L and the Y sounds are very... a soft and mushy sound, being like zh.
Mm-hmm.
The Caribbean accent is ja.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mexican would be ya. Yeah.
And so would Puerto Rican be considered more Caribbean?
Oh, it's definitely, yeah.
Ja.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
it's,
I remember
Puerto
hearing
Rico,
that.
Dominican Republic, and Cuba, we all tend to speak really fast and picked up a lot of words or the pronunciation from southern Spain and the Canary Islands, because a lot of people migrated from there to the
islands. And that's really where our Puerto Rican lineage is from the Canary Islands, right?
My grandmother's family.
Yeah, because we're
back in history.
Like really white.
Yeah.
For Puerto Rican people, we're white. Like people don't think
they
we look
say you don't
Puerto
look Puerto Rican.
We look more Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, my grandfather's family was from southern Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And there were still relatives there when I was a young girl.
Oh, interesting.
I'm sure they are there, but I've never met them.
Yeah, yeah, you grew up as an only child, so in some ways you didn't have a lot of extended family, did you?
No, I had a lot. I have a lot of cousins in Puerto Rico.
Oh, you do. Yeah. You just didn't have a big nuclear family,
right? My grandmother and grandfather had 5 children,
and that's your maternal grandmother and grandfather, your mother's
yes,
parents. Yeah.
Yes. I do not know my father's family at all.
You didn't know your father?
No. Well, I met him, but I don't remember him at all.
You met him when you were very young.
Well, yeah, I lived with him, you know, for a little bit. And then he would go to Puerto Rico, I'm told, to visit me.
Mm-hmm.
And then he and my mother got divorced when I was 2.
Yeah. So you wouldn't have a lot of, it, mostly what people told you about it.
Right.
Yeah, you
have
any really firsthand memories.
I see pictures, and he did leave me some records, very small records, where he talked to me in the records.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice. But you didn't maintain a relationship with him after they got divorced. I wonder how common that was back then.
Probably pretty common because of the distance.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's situationally common now. I think it happens to some people. They grow up without a father because, you know, they get divorced or they were never married and then they're just out of the picture. And then some people, you know, have joint custody like we did with when you guys got divorced, we had.
Well, I was kind of lucky. My mother saved pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could see what my grandmother on my father's side looked like.
Mm-hmm.
I had a picture of his brother, his aunt, one of his cousins. So I could see what that side of the family looked like.
Yeah, and you're getting more into doing genealogy now, huh?
Yes.
Yeah,
definitely.
That's interesting. I think that's cool. I'm interested to see some of the things that you uncover as you dig deeper. You lived across a lot of really interesting times. You know, we talk to like younger people today, right? I think they'll have a lot of stories to tell when they get older and they have kids or they have grandchildren, because they, for example, grew up during this information age, during this very heavy computer age. Like, I've met kids who never knew life without a cell phone, or they never knew life without the internet, or they never knew life without an iPod. So, like, the idea of a tape or a record or a CD is like very vintage and cool to them, which is super weird to me. But you grew up during major cultural shifts. You grew up during desegregation. You were a post-war baby. You saw desegregation. You grew up, you were actually at a prime age during the Vietnam War and during a lot, like a big, strong feminist movement.
Yes.
You know, you were probably, I'm assuming, relatively aware of Jim Crow when you were young. Like, these are things that you lived through, the Ku Klux Klan. Like, I'm definitely interested to hear your take on it, because even though, when did you move to the South?
Oh, after California, which was, what, 1979?
Yeah, so you went from Puerto Rico to Cleveland to back to New York?
No, I went to here to California.
Here to California and then to Texas. So you only ever really visited New York. You were born there and then you visited family there.
I spent 1 year, I think.
Gotcha.
When my mom was going through her divorce, I went to live with my aunt in New York.
In the Bronx?
She lived in Manhattan, but I had relatives in the Bronx also. Yeah. So I was all over the place.
Yeah. But you didn't come to Texas until you were an adult with basically starting a family.
Right.
So you lived farther north, which, as we know, during these kinds of civil rights processes, I guess progresses, everything happened a lot sooner in the north. So I think you're about the same age as a friend of mine who I went to high school with. Her her mother was about your age, but she grew up in Alabama. And I remember you telling me once, correct me if I'm wrong, that you saw desegregation in like elementary school and she saw desegregation in high school, and you guys were the same age.
Yeah, well, even in high school, there was a little bit of segregation.
Yeah, but I mean legal desegregation, like going to a school where it was enforced that...
Right. In my school, we had like three different backgrounds of people. There was the Black community. There was a huge Italian community. And then there was a mixed Central European community. There were no Puerto Ricans.
Oh, interesting. In Cleveland?
Well, not in my high school.
Yeah, it just wasn't a big
school. No. In Cleveland, there was a Puerto Rican community on the west side.
Gotcha. Well, I'm looking. So the Little Rock Nine, I think that that's probably a really good kind of historical marker, right? The students at Little Rock Central High School who basically tried to go into their high school and were blocked, and they had to bring in the National Guard. And it was a big turning point. That was in 1957.
Right.
So you were born when?
I was born in 48.
You're born in 48. So you would have been 9 years old when this happened. Right. So obviously it would have been on the news, right? You were aware of this happening. But what was school like for you? Was it desegregated the whole time you went? Like by the time you were in kindergarten, there were kids of other colors in your school?
Yes. The schools I went to were always mixed.
Gotcha.
Yeah. There was never a totally white school. Now, I'm pretty sure that there were some totally Black schools in some area of town. But it was simply because that is where the neighborhood was.
But it wasn't legally enforced.
In a part called Little Italy, most of the kids in school were Italian.
Yeah. But they weren't legally enforced at that point where you were growing up, just because things happened sooner there. But desegregation was pushing all over the South even when you were... I mean, isn't that weird to think about? The fact that you were alive during a time when, like... I mean... It's funny because we think about the horrific kind of race baiting that we hear coming out of Donald Trump's mouth and coming out of his supporters right now, and a lot of the like hatred towards immigrants, the hatred towards Muslims, kind of the under the radar, but also like the really overt racist things that are said. Does it remind you of a time when you used to live, or have you just kind of seen it
most
throughout
definitely
your life?
It reminds me of that. We did have some instances where people were very adamant about keeping the races separated, mm-hmm. but in personal life. Mm-hmm. Like, no problem with going to school or working with somebody, but not having friends that were of a different race.
Gotcha. You wouldn't marry somebody of a different race.
I mean, that was very bad at that time.
Taboo.
Yeah. I got in trouble in school for dancing with somebody who's black. Mm-hmm. I got called into the principal's office and told that I was going to start a riot.
That's so weird. Jeez. And so obviously, what was your awareness like during basically the civil rights movement? Like when you think about the Million Men March, when you think about Selma, and you think about these big events like in Martin Luther King's history before he was unfortunately assassinated. I mean, when he was assassinated, what was that, 68? I think so. Yeah, 68. So you would have been 20.
Yes.
So that must have been just defining for you.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking, because there was so much hope pinned on him. Mm-hmm. He was an incredible figure. And being Hispanic, mm-hmm. I probably saw it differently than a person who was maybe with a European background. Mm-hmm. I saw it as the person in this country that was able to bring everybody together because he saw everybody. And by that I mean he literally looked at you and saw you and heard you and knew that you were there. Mm-hmm. You had a face and you were a person. And that made a huge difference. Huge difference. Now, also understand that Puerto Rico was very integrated.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
In fact, that was, we never considered who's black, who's white. It was like, you're just Puerto Rican.
Oh, so when you were quite young and you were there, or when you would go back to visit, you didn't see a lot of that kind of segregation
there? No, not really. I'm sure there probably was some, but it wasn't anything that made the news. It wasn't overt. Maybe you knew one person who had that problem, and yeah. we did call it a problem.
Do you think yeah. that's because when we think about America and we think about these are ethnic minorities, although not for long, right?
Right.
Because we're starting Except to see Mexican Americans are growing. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, but when you do think about this historical time, there was a big pull for like white men to hold on to power. You're seeing it now, obviously,
yes.
too. This like death grip
well,
on power.
Fear. Yeah.
And that's fear, of course. But like, and it's because the white, I guess, Anglo, whatever you want to describe them as, Caucasian, were in the majority. And it was very easy when you say, oh, it's 13% African-American. That's a minority group. It's X percent, you know, Latino, which is also getting to be harder and harder to define. That's a minority group. Whereas in Puerto Rico, that's not a minority.
No. No, I would say at the time when I was growing up, it was at least half black.
Interesting. Yeah.
And
because it's Caribbean.
There were still some Indian. Right mm-hmm. now, it's very, very minor, the Indian population. They have a very hard time being recognized by the government
yeah.
because they think they were all wiped out.
Yeah.
But there are still some areas where they have Taino Indians.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Puerto Rico has a hard time being recognized. I mean, I know there's a lot of crises facing just the
yeah.
Commonwealth, is that what it is? Technically,
it's a commonwealth, yes, and it has a very interesting history with the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it continues to be, I think, somewhat tumultuous, both financially and in terms of like voter empowerment.
Yes,
yeah, it's a bit of an island without a home.
True, but at the same time, they have a choice, and I understand why they've made the choices that they've made mm-hmm. because of the history. There are still people alive who go way back and remember mm-hmm. the things that were done to the people on the island, experiments and things like that.
What yes. are you talking about?
Birth control.
Oh.
There were women who were given hysterectomies without them knowing that that's what they were getting. They actually experimented with birth control pills on the women in Puerto Rico.
Hmm.
Yes, before it was released out to the public. Droves and droves of men went to New York with the promise that they would be able to bring their families. Mm-hmm. They went to New York to work on the buildings, the great towers. And when they got there, they found that they were sleeping like 12 people in one small apartment.
Yeah.
They were brought on airplanes on lawn chairs.
On airplanes, on lawn
yes,
chairs.
Yes, cargo planes.
Gotcha.
And they sat in lawn chairs. There were pictures of hundreds of people just sitting in lawn chairs inside the airplane. Well, they were all men. And then they found out that they weren't making enough money to bring their families. It took a long time for them to be able to save the money to bring their families.
Bring their families where?
From Puerto Rico to New York.
For?
To live with them so they wouldn't be away from their families.
Sorry, what does this have to do with the birth control trials?
Oh, this was one of the parts of it, because when the men were gone, that's when the government moved in, the American government moved in and started trials on the women.
Yeah, this is fascinating. I'm looking this up. The Puerto Rico pill trials were following the Boston trials for the pill in 1954 and 1955. So there were these researchers, John Rock and Gregory Pincus, and they were having a hard time getting enough people to get the FDA approval for this. And so, you know, obviously some people would argue that they preyed and exploited sort of uneducated or illiterate women, poor women in this area. In later years, Pincus is, I'm quoting here from PBS, a PBS page about The Pill, which looks like it was a film that they made about birth control. Let's see. In later years, Pincus's team would be accused of deceit, colonialism, and the exploitation of poor women of color. The women had only been told that they were taking a drug that prevented pregnancy, not that this was a clinical trial, that the pill was experimental, or that there was a chance of potentially dangerous side effects. Pincus and Rock, however, believed they were following the appropriate ethical standards of the time. In the 1950s, research involving human subjects was much less regulated than it is today. Informed consent standards were minimal, and only the most basic toxicity tests were required for human trials. This is fascinating. I need to check out this documentary. It looks really interesting. Yes. On PBS. Yeah. Geez, that's really depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of some of the nuclear trials that were happening in the Marshall Islands, you know, just groups of people that were in some ways targeted because they were far away, because they were impoverished, because you could kind of do this without a lot of eyes on you at the time, mm-hmm. which is very sad. It's definitely something I'd like to learn more about. But at the time that was going on, for example, you were living in the U.S. and right. Was your mother also living in the U.S. or did she ever go back to Puerto Rico?
No, she went after I got married.
I see. Yeah. So she was in the U.S. for quite some time. Yes. And then she went back. Yes. To be with her mother or to be with family?
Well, she just wanted to move back to be with family. Mm-hmm. She lived in the area with family, and she was taking care of her mother.
Yeah.
She started a business, and she lived there pretty happily for quite a while.
I try to think about memories of, we called her our abuelita, which is like little grandmother in Spanish. She didn't speak English, did she?
Yes.
Or she did?
Actually, she did, well, but with a very heavy accent.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Because, yeah, I'm definitely remembering her not being easy to communicate, but I was so young, too. So young.
And it would be hard to understand her words. Yeah.
Yeah. She passed away when I was, or when you were.
Let's see. It was in 1991.
Yeah, so I would have been 8 years old. Yeah, so it was quite. And because she didn't live in the States, I only saw her when she would come visit.
That's correct, yeah.
I think we visited Puerto Rico maybe once or twice when I was young, but so young. I
think your sister visited twice. You visited once.
Yeah, I think I was an infant, too. I don't really have a memory.
You were 18 months old.
Yeah, yeah. So you obviously, you lived during a really, I think, historically fascinating time in America. You were basically, what, in college? In high school and college during Vietnam?
High school and college, both. Yeah. In high school, we were being told what was going on. Mm-hmm. It was the first time we saw an actual war in the newspaper.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And on television.
And on television, mm-hmm. yeah. And you had to be careful because with the younger kids, you didn't want them to see what was going on. The images were really scary.
Yeah, there was some new. There was news reports, obviously, around World War II, but you weren't born yet during those reports. And also, there's a lot of propaganda around wartime at yes. the time. But Vietnam was, we know historically from watching films and from learning about it, that this was a time of the war correspondent. This was the time of breaking. This was a time of strong protest. Also, and so exactly. there would be individuals who would go and they would document and they would bring that information back home so that people were really aware of what was going on, as opposed to World War II. Not saying that there probably wasn't any of that kind of journalism happening, but for the most part, World War II was a heavy time of propaganda, and it was a heavy time of kind of what many would consider the Great War, the moral war, a lot of patriotic support for the war.
Yes.
Vietnam was not like that.
Totally different attitude, yes.
Yeah.
Many people did not believe that we should be there. Many people did not believe that, well, we believed it was a war that wasn't being called a war. Mm. It was almost like being told, no, we're not at war. We're helping the South Vietnamese. And yet we were the ones who were losing. I mean, yes, South Vietnamese died, but we were losing so many young
men. Well, yeah, I think a lot of people would say the same thing about some of these more strategic, what would you call them, campaigns in Afghanistan or when we first invaded Iraq. Like, declaring, it's we live in a time now, I think, sort of Gen Xers and younger millennials, where the idea of like wartime is just it's always wartime,
right.
But like nothing's ever called a war. It's always like a campaign or like I don't know. There's all these euphemisms like, oh, we're only sending 10,000 troops or we're only sending, blah, blah, blah troops. And they're just, they don't call it an occupation. They don't call it a war. It's like a peace fighting mission or some sort of, it's just
yes.
trying to get around this idea of declaring war. So they were dancing with that in Vietnam as well.
They most definitely were dancing with it. And then don't forget there was a draft.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
how can you have a draft if you're not fighting war?
Yeah. So, but eventually it was called a war.
Yeah.
Yeah, eventually.
Well, everybody called it that.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know if the government ever
yeah.
termed it the war.
Well, historically they have,
yeah.
Obviously looking back in hindsight, at the very least, if they didn't during the time. And so, but the draft was only for men.
Yes.
Yeah. So you were never at risk of having to go to war, but obviously...
No. All
Men,
my friends
yeah,
were.
Your friends were. Did you have, did you have friends that were drafted? Did you have friends that enlisted on their own? And did you have friends that were draft dodgers?
I had all of those.
Yeah.
Yes. The friends that were draft dodgers, I never saw again.
Because they probably left the country.
There were just one or two.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. And they were mostly students that didn't make it in the university, because once you dropped out of the university, you had to go
mm-hmm.
to war. And so they would go to Canada.
Yeah.
I had friends that signed up for the war because it was inevitable. They were going to have to go anyway, so why not go and get it over with now?
Mm-hmm.
And then I had friends that were, well, they were drafted, almost everybody, that I knew was a number.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of kept from having to go by going to university. Now, that's not saying that everybody who went to university was doing it to dodge.
No,
going,
of course.
Right?
Of course. It just also happens to be that you were in that prime time. Your life was in many ways, I think, the inspiration for all the movies that we've seen, because that's usually the generation that is celebrated in film is youth.
Yes.
And you were that age. You were the age where you were young enough to have, I think, the glamour of youth, but old enough to have the thought processes of a thinking person, of a person who's making
right.
decisions about whether or not they are morally aligned
right.
with the government.
And since we were not around in World War II, like you said, we didn't have that feeling of, for any war, you have to be patriotic
mm-hmm.
because our boys are fighting there. we had questions.
Yeah.
Lots of questions that weren't being answered.
And so what was the experience like for you? Did you lose a lot of friends? Did you have friends that eventually came back? What yes. did you feel like the ratio
I
was?
I had a lot of friends that came back. I just know of two that died that I'm aware of.
That you were very close to?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But a lot of them were injured.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And a lot of them came back with, I would say, mental injuries, emotional injuries. Mm-hmm.
Did you, at the time, were you engaged in any sort of, well, I guess personally, did you protest the war? Were you against the war? Were you just confused about it?
I was definitely against it. It took me a little while to understand and read on my own what was happening, because some things that I would hear at school were not, to use a word we used then, jiving with what I was seeing on the news. And what I was hearing from my friends.
Sure, yeah.
So there was a process of putting all of that together. And when I was in college, I did join several protests.
Yeah. Yeah. So you did some activism back then.
Yes.
When you think about your life and the times when you have done activism, whether it be marching or, you know, letter signing campaigns or things like that, is Vietnam the only time that you've engaged in that, or have there been other things that you've spoken up about?
Very vocally and actually engaged in some kind of movement, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, there were injustices that I believe needed to be righted, but then it was letter writing.
Yeah.
It was expressing my opinion. I had a problem keeping my mouth closed.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, got into big arguments, big debates, that sort of thing, tried to explain what it is that the youth in our culture were feeling that was so different from the adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that resonates with a lot of people who are probably listening right now. I think I have a fair amount of listeners that are boomers that are sort of more in your age bracket, and I have a fair amount of listeners that are sort of Gen Xers and millennials that are more close to my age bracket. And I think that that resonates with sort of across that divide, because in a lot of ways we've experienced similar, especially in wartime, similar emotions around some of the decisions that were made. And I think this election recapitulates some of that. You know, this is an interesting time in American history. A lot of people would argue that this is one of the most ridiculous candidates that we've ever dealt with. I think that there have been some ridiculous candidates in the past, but it is sort of scary how much support we're actually seeing for Trump. And I'm definitely interested in your take, because you live in Texas, right? Like, you're a Southerner now.
Yes.
And historically, like, I remember there was a time when you were, you know, you supported McCain at the beginning. It took you a while to move over to the Obama camp because...
Yeah. Well, I supported McCain until Palin came into the picture.
Yeah. Because that pandering, just that overt, terrible pandering, really insulting to women, I think.
I think so, but also because she represented a closed mind, and I had a hard time with that. McCain, to me, he was a veteran. He was POW. He was somebody that you could look up to, and what I was hearing sounded good.
Well, and I think McCain in a lot of ways embodies, you know, I don't agree with a lot of his policies, and he would never have been my candidate, but I think that he embodies what we think of as the historical moderate Republican Party.
Yeah.
And then it just got worse and worse and worse. Like, do you think that Donald Trump represents most Republicans?
Of course not. Of course not. I don't think that most Republicans are that drastic.
Yeah. Donald Trump also doesn't really have any policies, you know, to speak of. So it's really hard to know what he actually does align himself with. But you see, living in Texas, supporters left and right, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I hear people who they feel that the government isn't their government anymore mm-hmm. because it contains things they are not comfortable with. And again, that's all it is. I remember when Obamacare first came out and teachers, friends mm-hmm. started saying, oh, that's just so horrible. And my first question was, well, did you read it? Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's supposed to be too big to read. I said, did you read any of it? Well, no, they were listening to what other people were saying.
Of course.
They were watching the TV and seeing these angry protesters, which were really just a few people, but were really vocal, extremely vocal. So I would read it and I would say, what's your question? And try to give them an answer from what I read. Or hold on, I'll go and check it out. And then it helped some. But there were still a lot who wouldn't. It was like, I don't want to know. Okay. I just want things to be the way they were. I don't want to know.
Yeah. I mean, that's fundamental to the idea of conservatism as opposed to progressivism, you know, is this idea of keeping things the way they are because they benefit a specific sect of people who are already in power. Why would somebody who's already in power want to see progress that actually dismantles that power and gives more power to individuals that have less? Yeah, I just watched a really brilliant documentary on Netflix about Noam Chomsky, I think In His Own Words or something like that. It's really beautiful. I'd recommend everybody see it, but it'll also really piss you off and make you sad, especially in the context of what's going on right now. I don't know. I don't want to talk about politics anymore. It's depressing. Okay. One thing that we haven't really jumped into is your life's work, which I think would resonate with a lot of my listeners, because even though this is a science podcast and you're not a scientist, you raised a scientist, but you yourself are not a scientist, you work in a very, I think, allied field with STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, because you work in education, or did.
Yes.
This is your first year of retirement.
It is.
So let everybody know, you know, what it is that you did for so many years.
Okay. I was a Spanish teacher. Mm-hmm. I have taught Spanish acquisition to students who spoke no Spanish. And I've also worked with populations that were native speakers or heritage speakers in teaching them their own native language, because studies have shown that the English that they learn will only go up to the level of the Spanish that they know. Hmm. So if you increase their knowledge of Spanish, then the knowledge of English goes up.
Gotcha. Because there's a difference between knowing how to read and write and knowing how to speak and being fully literate, right?
Right.
Understanding grammar, understanding idioms, understanding literary things.
Being able to write a paper.
Yeah. Very being able simple. To read a novel.
Right.
Yeah, we don't think about it, but obviously native Spanish speakers need to be able to do that in Spanish the way that we're expected to do that in English.
Right. And the population I was working with, most of them, even though they had bilingual classes, they were very poor language teachers. They didn't really teach language. Mm-hmm. And also, if they just came from, let's say, Mexico, they may have come from a good area where they had a good education, or they may have gone to school only half a year,
yeah,
or half a day because they couldn't afford to pay the teachers in their area. And so I had kids that were illiterate, essentially, and some, of course, had to teach English to all mm-hmm. of them. And English is a very difficult language to learn.
Yeah. And you, of course, are a little bit of a polyglot. You speak obviously Spanish and English fluently, but you also speak what?
I dabble in Portuguese and Italian, and I could read French.
Yeah, so it's kind of the Latin languages that are built right. on similar bases, and that must help, obviously.
Helps a great deal. Mm-hmm.
So you developed an interesting program towards the later years of your career when you were teaching in Plano, the suburb that we grew up in. But prior to that, you did teach more like in the inner city.
Yes. I've always taught inner city. I taught in Cleveland in the Huff area. Mm-hmm. And then here in Dallas, I taught in the east side of Dallas, which is mostly Hispanic. Mm-hmm. It's considered kind of a rough area. but I loved it.
Yeah, you taught at, what, Woodrow Wilson High School, well, for people who are listening.
Which
yeah.
is one of the oldest high schools in the Dallas area.
Beautiful. I used to come to visit you at school a lot. Yeah, I remember. You had a little portable building on the side where your classroom was because it was, you know, poor school.
Right.
And it was overflowing and overcrowded.
The first 2 years, I traveled from classroom to classroom. Mm-hmm. And then the third year, I had the portable. Mm-hmm. And my last year there, I finally moved inside, and my classroom was right over the principal's office, which is interesting.
I'm sure. But then you ended up coming to Plano, which is a more affluent city. You know, obviously, it's got a high median income, but you did teach on the east side of Plano, where basically the Hispanic population does live.
Yeah. Well, I was offered the job and semi-accepted the job at Plano Senior High. Mm-hmm. And luckily, before I signed any contracts, they called me from the middle school, Bowman Middle School. And it was the 4th of July, and I was surprised that anybody was in the school. Mm-hmm. But I said, you know, I'm not dressed for this. And they said, well, come over anyway. And we were there 3 hours talking about my past experiences, talking about the culture of the school we were in, and the demographic changes going on. And I wanted to be there because for Plano, that is the inner city school.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as Plano could have an inner city, that's where it would be. I mean, you know, every city has poorer populations. Even the nicest towns have these little pockets that are kind of hidden from view. And those were the kids that you were teaching.
Yes.
How many years did you spend at Bowman?
18.
18 years at Bowman. And how many years teaching overall?
24. Well, I didn't count the one in Cleveland, so 25.
So 24 years in Texas, 25 total. And towards the later years at Bowman, you developed a really interesting program, didn't you?
Yes. It was about 12 years ago, actually.
It was kind of in the middle.
I was looking to see what we could do for the Native population because the reading scores were down. Mm-hmm. And my foreign language administrator, she was over the foreign language for the district. She and I got together because I had been bothering her about it for a while. And she said, okay, guess what? There is a possibility here. The state is helping through the ESL program, helping to pay for schools who want to set up a program for native speakers.
Yeah.
So what we did was we tested all the sixth graders in my school who spoke Spanish.
And because in Plano, middle school is 6 through 8.
Yes.
Yeah, just to clarify. It's not the case everywhere. Yeah.
So we tested all the sixth graders. Mm-hmm. And the first year, we were very selective. We gave them, like, tests that showed that they could do Spanish 1, tests that showed they could do Spanish 2, and then they were allowed to go into Spanish 3.
And Spanish 1 is usually offered in 9th grade, right? Or is it 8th grade?
9th grade when you're in high school.
High school, yeah.
7th grade in middle school.
And then
Plano.
And that's usually Spanish 1 is combined in 7th and 8th grade in middle
school.
Right,
it's one semester for each year.
Gotcha. Or you take it your first year of high school.
Right.
Spanish 2 is usually 10th grade. Spanish 3 would be, you know, that makes sense. 11th grade, Spanish 4 would be 12th grade if you take all of that.
Exactly.
And so by the time you're in Spanish 3 or 4, you can take an AP test.
At level 4, you can take
at level 4. I see. So only at level 4. So that means you've already put in either 4 full years of Spanish or potentially close to 5 years of Spanish if you started in middle school.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What we were seeing in the district, however, was that a lot of the Hispanic kids were not graduating. They were leaving early.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reason for a small group in that they came to Plano or to the United States later on in their education. So they had already finished school in Mexico.
Gotcha.
And since they were still under the age of 18, they had to continue education here.
And they didn't want to, so they would drop out.
Right.
Yeah.
They would just go to work. There was that. They were not getting into the academic programs at all. Plano East had the International Baccalaureate program. Mm-hmm. There was not one Hispanic in it.
Yeah. So there's just a lot of barriers to entry there.
Yes. Yes. Then they were not doing as well with ESL. Mm. They were not graduating out of that program fast enough. So we took a look at all these things. We consider these students at-risk students.
Yeah.
And that's the population that we were trying to get into the program.
So, but these were all Latino students that were at risk.
All native speakers, yes.
So native speakers at risk of either not graduating first and foremost or of obviously not continuing on to college.
Right, right. So we determined that in order to sell this to the district, mm-hmm. to the school board, we said, okay, let's get this to level 3 and 4 AP and have the students take the AP test in eighth grade. It's not a modified test. It's the regular AP test.
So this is a test most kids take as seniors that they're doing all of the work to prepare them to take it by the time they're in eighth grade.
Right.
And these are kids that might not graduate high school. So it's right. obviously not for lack of intellect.
Right.
Yeah.
So we proved that they did have the intelligence. What they needed was to raise their level in their language mm-hmm. so that they could express that. What they didn't have was enough English knowledge, mm-hmm. and putting them in an English class wasn't giving it to them. They still had that barrier of another language that kept them from getting there. It was amazing. The reading scores went up in English. We tracked for a few years how they were doing in their other classes, and they were amazing. Their scores went up in all the classes. I had teachers who would tell me about those students. They would call them my kids. Mm-hmm. And they would say, oh, I have one of your kids in my class, and she was giving her opinion on this, and I didn't know that these kids knew that much about this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it thrived. It is now in 6 of the 12 middle schools, mm-hmm. or 13 middle schools in Plano. And I think it's behind this new movement to have a foreign language in elementary school.
Which is great. It's crazy to me that here in the States we don't do that. People from other countries are like, what are you thinking, waiting until you're in eighth or ninth grade to start teaching another language? It's so much harder to learn once you're that age. But beyond that, I think part of what's so inspiring about this program is that you have a group of kids who are underrepresented, underserved, at risk, potentially might not usually finish high school, very rarely actually go to college, and that's for various cultural reasons. Maybe mom and dad want them to get to work. Maybe they have a lot of siblings and they need to help raise money for them. Or maybe they've never been told that that was the path that they could take. You know, for whatever reason, it just didn't feel like it was the direction that they could go. By the time they're done with eighth grade and they've taken Spanish 4 AP,
yes.
How many potential college credits do they then have under their belt if they did well?
Okay. It depends on the university they go to. Mm-hmm. Private universities usually give less credit. Mm-hmm. The public ones give a lot more.
So let's say they went to where I went to school, the University of North Texas, a public university that's only 45 minutes from the town I grew up in.
They could potentially get 19 credits.
Yeah, that's crazy.
In Spanish, yeah.
That's more than half of a year of college under their belt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and really all they would need to do was take maybe another class or two to end up with a minor.
Yeah. No, if that, yeah. 19 credits might actually satisfy their minor.
18
satisfies a minor, yeah.
But they usually require them to take at least one class
more, just
at,
like
the
at the university.
Yeah.
Or they could even potentially start out a major that way. Because, yes. I mean, more than anything, what it seems to me is obviously it catches these at-risk kids and puts them on a path.
Yes.
But it also helps, I think, them and helps their family see that college is more attainable because basically they've already done some of the work.
Right.
And they don't have to pay for it.
Yes.
Which is big.
That is fantastic for these kids. Mm-hmm. But we learn more than just the language in the class. And this is the fascinating part about it. They learn for the AP test, you have to know how to write a paper at a college level.
Mm-hmm.
They learn to listen because there aren't classes that teach you how to listen.
Especially not when you're in eighth grade.
Right.
Yeah, it's not a skill most eighth graders have.
They learn to speak at a college level.
Mm-hmm.
and they learn to read material that is written at the adult and college level.
I mean, you're reading literature with these kids.
Now, on top of that, we also teach cultures. Mm-hmm. So that if they're Mexican, they're learning about the Argentinian culture, about the Spanish culture. And because on the AP test, they have to compare those cultures to the culture they live in, mm-hmm. now they have to learn all about the American culture. So they could answer questions based on it without knowing what the question's going to be ahead of time.
Yeah.
So it teaches them a great deal. We also learn art. And there are so many of the kids that are now, you know, going to museums, becoming art majors. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it touches every aspect of their lives. I've had kids that had a full ride to MIT.
That must be really rewarding,
yes.
You know, putting in all that work. Because I know teachers are definitely overworked and undervalued in a lot of ways. And by undervalued, I mean underpaid.
Yes.
That's something that teachers deal with quite a bit. But you are in your first year of retirement.
Right.
You're still doing some work.
Yes.
Some help with curriculum planning and with, like, administrative things.
Yes.
Helping to see.
Training teachers.
Training teachers. Helping to make sure that the program is a legacy program and that it continues. I know that's important for you. And figuring out what some of your next steps are. You're allowed to work still. You can just only work part-time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I don't see you as somebody who's not going to work.
Yes. And I love the classroom, so I still substitute teach.
Yeah. Yeah. So you find your way back there a lot, which I think is great. You know, we've been talking for quite a while, and I think it may be time now on the podcast to start to wind down, unless there's anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to. It's so weird, you guys, interviewing your own mom.
I'll bet.
Yeah. Is it weird being interviewed by your daughter?
No, because you've done it before and you just don't know.
Yeah, that's
true.
Kids interview their parents.
In high school, you had
a project
that you had to write all this stuff down.
Yeah, I could see that.
But it wasn't just you. It was almost all the students I've had that have gone on to high school who took that course.
Yeah.
They came back and interviewed me in the middle
school. But usually not with this big crazy microphone and these big headphones and blasting it for all the world to hear.
Were scribbling like crazy.
Yeah. Old school reporter style. But before I close every episode, I ask my guests the same two questions, and I don't see any reason that I wouldn't ask you. I'm definitely interested to hear your answers to this, because I don't think I've ever asked you these things. I'm sure I've mentioned them in passing, but never specifically these two questions. So, I ask every guest the same too. And it's very important, I think, that you realize that it doesn't matter what context you want to answer in. It could be very personal for you, or it could be, you know, big picture, global for the world. But I basically want to know two things. The first, sort of on the bummer side, is when you think to the future, what is the thing that most, you know, is most disconcerting to you? What keeps you up at night? What makes you the most worried? And then on the flip side of that, when you think to the future, what are you most optimistic and hopeful for? What do you look forward to the most?
Okay. I'll take the first one first.
Yeah.
The thing that is most disconcerting is the lack of respect for education.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing as civilization depends on educating the youth and
adults.
And adults.
Yeah.
And turning them into lifelong learners, which a lot of people just stop. I mean, they get to a certain point, I'm done with school. Kind of crazy, but I'm done with school. It scares me that education is being run by politicians mm-hmm. rather than educators.
Especially where you live in Texas, where there's so many problems with the school board and so many problems with textbook writing and curriculum planning that affects the whole country.
Yeah, it's very difficult to loosen the purse strings of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems everybody wants a say as far as what to teach and what levels when they are not educators.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of agendas that people are trying to push through. That's one thing we didn't get into was religion, but that's obviously something that, she just rolled her eyes, guys, if you can't see. I'm an atheist. My mom's not religious, but she has a history. You know, we were Mormon for a time. Mm-hmm. She's no longer religious either, but definitely, I think she gets you right. You get just as frustrated with.
I get very frustrated.
Yeah, with a lot of the kind of evangelical right and the pressures that they put, especially when they start to step on the toes of education.
Yes.
And,
yes.
and sort of try to rewrite history to fit their narrative.
Exactly. There are things that are just made up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people agree with them, which is scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Political power.
So that ignorance spreading is something that scares me.
I think people listening are like, okay, she's your daughter. I see it. What about, what do you look forward to? What are you excited about?
I am excited about, not on a global level, but on a personal level here, is being able to come up with something that I can do to kind of start over.
Oh, yeah.
I retired from teaching in the public school sector, but I haven't retired from life. So there are things that I want to dabble in and see if I can develop something, make something grow. That would be fantastic.
Any ideas of what some of those things might be?
Oh, genealogy, mm-hmm. I've been looking into. And these things that I do, I don't necessarily want to get paid for them.
Yeah.
They're just fun to do. I really want to get into genealogical research and maybe help other people who want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I have thought about training teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen some deficits in some of the training that they're receiving, and there are some areas that I think I could close the gap in, especially for preparing teachers for taking the state boards, mm-hmm. the state tests, the very weak preparation for that.
Gotcha.
Also, extending language in the state of Texas, mm-hmm. even though it is one of the states that really, really teaches a lot of Spanish. like California, for example, they were starting the middle school program maybe 4 or 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
because I had some come to my classroom to observe, and they said they were the first ones in California to do this. But I would like to get that out there. You know, we have a huge Hispanic population.
Yeah.
And so we don't want a huge ignorant population.
No, it's pretty stupid to not be able. I don't speak Spanish well, but I can at least get by in Texas because, like, you're going to encounter people who don't speak English.
Yes,
it's important to be able to communicate with them.
But I'm also looking at the Hispanic population to be educated.
That's true.
And yes, it usually takes about 5 years for a person who has come to this country, an immigrant, to get fluent enough in the language.
And that's with help. That's with work.
That's with immersion.
That's with immersion. That's with actually taking the time to try, you know, not just, you know, there are ways, I think, to avoid it if you want to, if you live in a neighborhood where you don't really have to and you only go to markets where you don't really have to. But
exactly.
if you have kids, good luck.
Yes.
Because they're going to be speaking English and they're going to be talking to you in English.
Yeah, that's one of my experiences. Yeah. The younger the kids, the less Spanish they know.
That's true.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because this you're saying that you want to start doing things that are a little different. And they are different, but they're close to the box. They're not that outside of the
box.
I'm
a teacher.
Genealogy, sure, that's outside. Is there anything that you've ever wanted to do, anything that you're really excited to try that's just like totally out of left field for you?
I'm trying. I've always wanted to jump out of a plane.
Well, you could do that tomorrow if you just got to pay for it. Yeah, if your blood pressure lets you. And I know you do some gardening. You know, you do some art and things like that. But no big thing where you're like, man, I just want to learn that skill.
Oh, yes. I want to learn Japanese.
Oh, interesting.
Of course, another language.
Another language, but still. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yes, I would love to learn Japanese.
I love it. All right. Yeah. I like it.
And I might even go back into karate. I'm not sure yet.
Oh, yeah. You used to do a lot of karate when you were
I am lifting weights for the first time in my life, and I'm enjoying that.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. I hope to be doing the same thing when I'm 35 years older than I am, because you're exactly 35 years older than I am.
That's right.
So that's how I always remember how old you are. Or,
close to it.
Yeah, or on the flip side, that's how I remember how old I am. You know it's bad when you start going, okay, what year was I born? What year is it? And you have to, like, calculate it out. Anyway, this was a lot of fun. Thank you. You made it easy for me.
Oh, good.
I was nervous.
I enjoyed it.
Good. I'm glad. Usually I do a shout out at the end for people to reach people on social media, but, you know, I know you're not big on social media.
I know. Just Facebook. I read Twitter.
Yeah, she reads Twitter, but she is on Facebook. If you want to say hi to my mom, you can. Charlotte Salmon.
Yes.
That's her married name. It's spelled like salmon.
Yes.
Pretty straightforward. Easy to find. And other than that, I just want to thank you for coming on and spending time with me today.
You're very welcome. This was fun.
Yeah. And now we're going to get back to her vacation so we can actually enjoy some time together in LA. Guys, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.